Well, first of all, what were the factors that brought together the academic economists for this book?
Well, I think what really was a driving factor was a reality that we increasingly see in rural America and across large swaths of the country, that some of the traditional economic development practices, such as jobs creation and going after particular businesses to locate an area for job creation and income creation, just weren't having the long-term impacts on the viability of many rural communities. And so many of my colleagues really started to look for some alternatives. And so that was part of the reason for the book. And second of all, there was an increasing interest coming from USDA, in particular Secretary Vilsack, after he came on as the new Secretary of Agriculture. And so those are probably a couple of the two major factors that led to the colleagues that I co-edited the book with to focus on wealth creation.
What do you think are the guiding principles of the book?
Well, I think one of the big guiding principles is that we want to think of wealth as an asset that generates a return, just like you would think of you going in and purchasing a stock and making an investment there, okay? That stock can increase in value, but it also can generate a dividend. That's a type of return. And so when we think of a community, they can have all different types of wealth, and those generate returns, and those returns go to individuals that live in those communities and can be in the form of income and other types of quality of life factors. And so that's probably the largest guiding principle. Second is that rural communities can think of their wealth as going up and down based on how they choose to invest or not invest in these typical types of wealth assets. And you can think of that, a good analogy is that like a bathtub. And so when you make investments in different assets in your community, that level of wealth in that bathtub, that water line is going to rise. At the same time, many of these assets may depreciate, or you may go ahead and use many of these assets and then they deplete, and that's sort of like the water coming out of the bathtub going through the drain. And so that's another sort of principle, is that these wells represent stocks of investments in your community and that they can grow and decline depending on your level of investment. It's also important when we talk about wealth that there's many different types of wealth. And when people hear the term wealth, the first thing that comes to their mind is financial wealth. They think of dollars and cents. But our book takes an approach to wealth as being much more comprehensive across a number of different types of categories. And so you can think of wealth being in the form, not just of financial wealth, but in physical wealth. Your homes, the physical houses that you live in are an example of that. There's also natural forms of wealth, the amenities, the rivers and lakes and streams, mountains. Those types of assets are another form of wealth. Human investments, for example, individuals' educational attainment, others, is another form of wealth. We can think of, from the business sector, there's intellectual forms of wealth, like businesses that create knowledge that we might codify in the form of a patent or a trademark or a copyright. Others are social forms of wealth, so we think about the relationships, the networks that we might have in our community. We think of things like our social organizations and religious organizations, and we think of the ties that individual members of a community have together. That's another form of wealth. We also have things like cultural wealth, and in different parts of the country, we see those come out. In Louisiana, we have great traditions both in the northern and southern part of our state and our rural areas around some of these cultural artifacts that really represent wealth in these places. And there's also political wealth and the ability that our communities, individuals can organize in a way to get certain types of actions and returns done throughout their community. So those are three. Finally, it's important to understand that you can think of wealth in different dimensions. And so, for example, one way to think about that is you can think of wealth as being in an individual place, regardless of who owns it. So, for example, if you think of a subdivision, you think of a collection of homes, those houses are going to be there regardless of whether someone's in them or not. And that means that an individual place, an individual community can leverage those. So, for example, if a new large manufacturing facility may be coming into a community, if you have those stocks of available homes, those can be leveraged by new individuals coming in so they can live and work in the community. On the other hand, you can think of wealth from a people-based perspective, and that's the idea of ownership. And we can use that same homeowner's example. So someone takes out a mortgage on a house, and when you take out that mortgage, you may have a certain amount of down payment, and then you have a balance on that mortgage of a given amount. And you make payments each month, and the amount of ownership or the equity that you have in that home represents that portion that you own, and then the remaining amount of wealth in that house is owned by the bank or someone that may hold a mortgage-backed security from which your mortgage resides. And so that's a way to think about that. Another way to think about it is public wealth versus private wealth. And so when we have communities that organize themselves in towns and parishes, what happens is that we typically will tax ourselves, and in return for that, we will deliver public services, and a part of delivering that, we will have certain types of public wealth assets that will be created in the process. And consequently, those are part of an overall community's wealth in addition to the wealth, people-based wealth that's privately owned. So those are, when we think about it, a number of the different guiding principles about wealth in the wealth creation book.
Okay, well, how do you hope the book will influence research and practice going forward?
I think my co-authors that wrote chapters in the book, as well as the overall team that edited the book, really thought that this book is going to help initiate a new research agenda that's really focused on comprehensive wealth in a community, and that we can actually use wealth as a measure of long-run prosperity for rural communities as well as their sustainability. That is, as long as we're seeing overall wealth increasing in all of these forms, and that's a representative of a very prosperous community, whether in a rural location or urban location for that matter, and that in the long run they're sustainable because you're not depleting those types of wealth assets in a way that they reduce the long-run return. All those wealth assets that we talked about provide a return, maybe in the terms of incomes that residents might receive, and others, meaning the quality of life characteristics. Probably one of the other areas that we hope the book will influence is looking at wealth as a unit that we need to focus on measurement. What we typically see in society is that we measure what we value. Okay, and so if we typically look today, if you listen on the radio or check on the internet, you'll see in information about the economy, you'll see things such as the number of jobs created or the unemployment rate or those types of measures. And those things are measured because that's what we currently value. And so one of the things we hope that this will influence is an effort by research scholars to find more effective ways of measuring wealth, particularly some of these wealth measures that are typically not traded in the marketplace. And, you know, we would typically expect that it's easy to measure forms of wealth that are traded because there's going to be a price that's going to be placed on there so you can value them. And so we need to find best practice and research strategies that are going to effectively value or price these non-market forms of wealth. Another area that we hope that the book will influence is to use wealth as the framework for evaluating policy proposals and rural development efforts, because one of the things that we typically see is that we often evaluate a given program or policy based off of some of these short-term measures, like jobs and income or maybe tax revenue in the short term, but they don't evaluate some of the long-term impacts. And in Louisiana, for example, we deal with a lot of storms like hurricanes. And one of the things we often see is a very short-term positive economic impact. We'll see an increase in the number of jobs and the amount of incomes that are earned by residents, even short-term increases in the tax revenue that comes into state and individual parishes and municipalities. However, one of the things that we often see is that those types of short-run effects run their course and then we see a drop-off. And what we're hoping through this book is to have those communities reevaluate what measures they should be using to look at the types of recovery and resilience that communities have from these types of disasters. Another way we hope the book will influence research and practice going forward is using wealth as a metric for evaluating policy proposals and other rural development efforts. A good case in point is what we see in Louisiana after tropical natural disasters such as hurricanes. We often see this real short-term bounce from increased jobs from the recovery, incomes earned by residents, even tax revenue at the state and local levels increase. Unfortunately, those are really short-term effects and then drop off. What we typically don't measure as closely is the change in some of these particular wealth assets. And those are the ones in many cases are what were damaged. So we see stocks of housing that were damaged. We see public wealth such as schools that are damaged. We see roads and bridges that are damaged. And so we don't measure what's lost and then evaluate how that changed and how we build back and or build better and smarter to generate our wealth stocks in such a way that they will provide us long-term returns and make our communities more resilient and prosperous going forward.
Okay, well, you recently received a new grant from the USDA titled Measuring and Modeling Wealth for Sustainable and Broad-Based Rural Prosperity. How did the book influence what you will be doing with the grant?
Really, one of the research focuses of this grant is to try to identify methods to price or value different types of wealth assets, particularly those wealth assets that do not have a particular market where they can be traded. That's important as the book sort of highlights, and one of the reasons that the grant focuses on this particular method is that we need to find ways to measure some of these non-market wealth assets, because if we can effectively measure their value, then we'll have a better way of understanding when we want to invest more in those particular assets and look at how they generate certain types of returns. Another focus of the grant is to better make a linkage between the value or the level of these wealth asset investments and the return that they provide. And because that's really going to be an important element, because understanding those types of returns are going to give us a better understanding of optimal development strategies where we invest in these different forms of wealth. Another focus of the grant is on education. And what's important here is that we're trying to redevelop curricula around this wealth creation framework in our rural development courses. And one of the particular objectives in this education focus is on developing a new introductory graduate level or a senior undergraduate level rural policy course that's taught from this wealth creation framework as really a lens for how we do policy analysis going forward. And that's real important because, as I said before, depending on the different types of development strategy, we may want to use wealth as a central focus on measuring how a community is improving or declining. Also, what we're going to be doing in this grant is trying to create independent rural policy modules that we can post online that can be used for instructors that want to add individual focused rural policy elements into their curriculum. So you may have an agricultural policy course that wants to focus on not an entire rural policy curriculum, but an individual component of that. And so these are going to allow other faculty across the country to implement the wealth creation framework through specific targeted rural policy modules.
Okay, one more question. What do you think is the role of the LSU Ag Center and the College of Agriculture in rural development in the 21st century?
What we have seen in the past century was an effort in rural development that was largely focused about how we transition from a rural America that was very farm dependent to one that became much more diversified in the latter half of the 20th century. That diversification, as agricultural technology improved and there was less of a need for physical human labor, what we saw was that a portion of that population migrated to urban areas, but there was still an interest for a certain percentage of the population to stay in rural areas, and so diversification was a strategy. One of the challenges has become, as our technologies have changed, the types of economies of scale that have required for many of the types of non-farm businesses to stay viable has resulted in their needing increasingly large populations to survive. And so one of the challenges has been as many of these rural areas have not been able to maintain the types of services that you would hope to have for a high quality of life. But what we really see in the 21st century then is a change in role where rural America needs to identify its relevance in order that the entire country's prosperity, resiliency can move forward. One of the things we need to realize is as we increase our ability to measure and value rural America's wealth assets and their contributions to urban America, then we would hopefully build the evidence base and provide best practice on how we invest in rural people and places where those wealth assets are located. You have to realize that rural residents are on the front lines as stewards of these wealth assets, and the consequences of allowing these communities to erode is the increased cost of maintaining and growing these assets from more distant urban centers.